Back in the church basement in Norsbrook, Sweden, Rudy yells and drops a cigarette on the floor, having allowed it to burn down to his fingers like a slow fuse while relating this story. He puts his hand to his mouth, sucks on the finger briefly, then remembers his manners and composes himself.
Goering knew a surprising amount about cryptology and was aware of my work on the Enigma. He didn't trust the machine. He told me that he wanted me to come up with the very best crypto system in the world, one that could never be broken. He wanted to communicate, he said, with U-boats at sea and with installations in Manila and Tokyo. And so I came up with such a system.
And you handed it over, Bischoff says.
Yes, Rudy says. And here, for the first time all day, he allows himself a slight smile.
And it is a reasonably good system, despite the fact that I crippled it before giving it to Goering.
Crippled it? Root asks. What do you mean?
Imagine a new engine for an aeroplane. Imagine it has 16 cylinders. It is more powerful than any other engine in the world. Even so, a mechanic can do certain things, very simple things, to kill its performance, such as pulling out half of the spark plug wires, or tampering with the timing. This is an analogy to what I did with Goering's crypto system.
So what went wrong? Shafto asks. They figured out that you had crippled it?
Rudolf von Heckelhaber laughs.
Not very likely. Maybe half a dozen people in the world could figure that out. No, what went wrong was that you fellows, you allies, landed in Sicily, and then in Italy, and not long afterwards, Mussolini was overthrown, the Italians withdrew from the Axis, and Angelo, like all of the other hundreds of thousands of Italian nationals living and working in the Reich, fell under suspicion. His services were badly needed as a test pilot, but his situation was tenuous. He volunteered for the most dangerous work of all, flying the new Messerschmitt prototype with the turbine jet engine. This proved his loyalty in the eyes of some. Remember that at the same time I was decrypting the message traffic of Detachment 2702. I kept these results to myself, as I no longer felt any particular loyalty to the Third Reich. There had been a great burst of activity around the middle of April, and then no messages for a while, as if the detachment had ceased to exist. At exactly the same time, Goering's people were very active for a few days. They were afraid that Bischoff was going to broadcast the secret of U-553.
So you know about that? Bischoff asks.
Natürlich.
U-553 was Goering's treasure ship. Its existence was supposed to be a secret. When you, Sergeant Shafto, turned up on board Bischoff's U-boat, talking about this thing, Goering was very concerned for a few days. Then everything settled down, and there was no Detachment 2702 traffic through the late spring and early summer. Mussolini was overthrown in late June. Then the troubles began for me and Angelo. The Wehrmacht was defeated by the Russians at Kursk. Absolute proof for those who needed it that the Eastern Front is lost. Since then, Goering has redoubled his efforts to get his gold, jewels, and art out of the country.
Rudy looks at Bischoff.
I am frankly surprised that he has not tried to recruit you.
Dönitz has, Bischoff admits.
Rudy nods. It all fits.
During all of this, Rudy continues, I received only one message intercept in the Detachment 2702 code. It took my machinery several weeks to break it. It was a message from Enoch Root, stating that he and Sergeant Shafto were in Norsbrook, Sweden, and requesting further instructions. I was aware that Captain Leutnant Bischoff was also in the same town, and became interested. I decided that this would be a good place for me and Angelo to escape to.
Why?
Shafto says.
Of all the places...
Enoch and I had never met, but there are certain old family connections, Rudy says, and certain shared interests.
Bischoff mutters something in German.
The connections make a very long story. I would have to write a whole fucking book,
Rudy says irritably. Bischoff looks only slightly appeased, but Rudy goes on anyway.
It took us several weeks to make preparations. I packed up the Leibniz archive.
Hold on, the what?
Certain materials I used in my research. They have been scattered among many libraries all over Europe. Goering brought them all together for me. It makes men like him feel powerful to do these little favors for their slaves. I departed from Berlin last week on the pretext of going to Hanover to do my Leibniz research. Instead, I made my way to Sweden through channels that were quite involved.
No shit. How'd you manage that little stunt?
Shafto asks. Rudy looks at Enoch Root as if expecting him to answer the question. Root shakes his head minutely.
It would be too tedious to explain here,
Rudy says, sounding mildly annoyed. I found Enoch. We got a message to Angelo saying that I was safe here. Angelo then tried to make his escape in the Messerschmitt prototype, with the results that we have all seen.
A long pause.
And now, here we are,
says Bobby Shafto.
Here we are, agrees Rudolf von Heckelhaber.
What do you think we should do?
Asks Shafto.
I think we should form a secret conspiracy, says Rudolf von Heckelhaber offhandedly, as if proposing to go in together on a fifth of bourbon. We should all make our way separately to Manila, and once we arrive, we should take some, if not all, of the gold that the Nazis and the Nibbanese have been hoarding there.
What do you want with a shitload of gold?
Bobby asks.
You're already rich.
There are many deserving charities, Rudy says, looking significantly at Root. Root averts his eyes.
There is another long pause.
I can provide secure lines of communication, which is the sine qua non of any secret conspiracy, says Rudolf von Heckelhaber. We will use the full-strength, uncrippled version of the same cryptosystem that I invented for Goering. Bischoff can be our man on the inside, since Dönitz wants him so badly. Sergeant Shafto can be...
Don't even say it. I already know,
says Bobby Shafto. He and Bischoff look at Root, who's sitting on his hands, staring at Rudy, looking oddly nervous.
Enoch the Red, your organization can get us to Manila,
von Heckelhaber says. Shafto snorts.
Don't you think the Catholic Church has its hands sort of full right now?
I'm not talking about the Church, Rudy says. I'm talking about Societas Eruditorum.
Root freezes.
Congratulations there, Rudy,
Shafto says.
You surprised the Padre. I didn't think it could be done. Now, would you mind telling us what the fuck you're talking about?
Horde. Like a client of one of your less reputable pufferfish sushi chefs, Randy Waterhouse does not move from his assigned seat for a full 90 minutes after the jumbo leaves Ninoy Aquino International Airport. A can of beer is embedded in the core of his spiraled hand. His arm lies on the extra-wide business-class armrest, a shank on a slab. He does not turn his head or turret his eyeballs, even, to look out the window at northern Luzon. All that's out there is jungle, which has two sets of connotations going for it now. One is the spooky Tarzan, Stanley and Livingston, the horror, natives are restless, Charlie's out there somewhere waiting for us, kind. The second is the more modern and enlightened sort of Jacques Cousteauian, teeming repository of brilliant and endangered species, lungs of the planet kind. Neither really works for Randy anymore, which is why, despite the state of hibernatory torpor he shunted into the moment his ass impacted on the navy blue leather of the seat, he feels a little spike of irritation every time one of the other passengers, peering out a window, pronounces the word jungle. To him, it is just a shitload of trees now. Trees going on for miles and miles, up the little hilly-willies and down the little hilly-willies. It is easy now for him to understand Tropical Denizen's shockingly frank and blunt craving to drive through this sort of territory in the largest and widest available bulldozers, The only parts of his body that move during the first hour and a half of the flight are certain facial muscles, which pull the corners of his mouth back into an ironic rictus when he imagines what Charlene would think of this. It is just too perfect. Randy goes off on a business foray and comes back identifying with people who bulldoze rainforests. Randy wants to bulldoze the jungle, all of it. Actually, thermonuclear weapons, detonated at a suitable height, would do the job faster. He needs to rationalize this urge. He will do so, as soon as he solves the running out of planetary oxygen problem. By the time it even occurs to him to lift the beer to his lips, the heat of his body has gone into it, and his hand has become as chilly and stiff as an uncooked rolled roast. For that matter, his whole body has adjourned into some kind of metabolic recess, and his brain is not exactly purring at high RPMs either. He feels kind of the way he does, sometimes, the day before he comes down with a total body cold and flu scenario, one of those crushing viral Tet offensives that every few years swats you out of the land of the fully living for a week or two. It is as if about three-quarters of his body's resources of nutrients and energy have been diverted to the task of manufacturing quintillions of viruses. At the currency exchange window of Naya, Randy had stood behind a Chinese man who, just before he stepped back from the window with his money, unloaded a sneeze of such titanic force that the rolling pressure wave turbulating outwards from his raw, flapping facial orifices caused the wall of bulletproof glass separating him from the money changers to flex slightly, so that the reflection of the Chinese man, Randy behind him, the lobby of Naya, and the sunlit passenger drop-off lane outside underwent a subtle warpage. The viruses must have roiled back from the glass, reflected like light, and enveloped Randy. So maybe Randy is the personal vector of this year's version of the flu named after some city in East Asia that annually tours the United States, just barely preceded by rush shipments of flu vaccine. Or maybe it's Ebola. Actually, he feels fine. Other than the fact that his mitochondria have gone on strike or that his thyroid seems to be failing, perhaps it was secretly removed by black market organ transplanters. He makes a mental note to check for new scars in the next mirror. He is not experiencing any viral symptoms at all. It is some kind of post-stress thing. This is the first time he has relaxed in a couple of weeks. Not once has he sat down in a bar with a beer or put his feet up on a desk or just collapsed like a decaying corpse in front of the television set. Now his body is telling him it's payback time. He does not sleep. He does not feel drowsy at all. Actually, he's been sleeping rather well, but his body refuses to move for an hour and then most of another hour, and to the extent his brain is working at all, it can only chase its tail. But there is something that he could be doing. This is why laptops were invented, so that important business persons would not fritter away long flights relaxing. He can see it right there on the floor in front of him. He knows he should reach for it, but it would break the spell. He feels as if water condensed on his skin and froze into a carapace that will shatter as soon as he moves any part of his body. This is, he realizes, exactly how a laptop computer must feel when it drops into its power-saving mode. Then a flight attendant is there holding a menu in front of his face and saying something that jolts him like a cattle prod. He nearly jumps out of his seat, spills his beer a little, gropes for the menu. Before he can drop back into his demi-coma, he continues the motion and reaches down for his laptop. The seat next to him is empty, and he can put his dinner over there while he works on the computer. People around him are watching CNN, live from CNN Center in Atlanta, not a canned thing on tape. According to the plethora of pseudo-technical data cards jammed into the seat backs, which Randy is the only person who ever reads, this plane has some kind of antenna that can keep a lock on a communication satellite as it flies across the Pacific. Furthermore, it's two-way, so you can even transmit email. Randy spends a while familiarizing himself with the instructions, checks the rates, as if he really gives a shit how much it costs, then jacks the thing into the anus of his laptop. He opens up the laptop and checks his email. Traffic is low because everyone at Epiphyte knows he's en route somewhere. Nevertheless, there are three messages from Kia, Epiphyte's only actual employee, the administrative assistant for the whole company. Kia works in a totally alienated, abstracted office in the Springboard Capital Corporate Incubator Complex in San Mateo. It is some sort of a federal regulation that nascent high-tech companies must not hire pudgy 50-year-old support staff the way big established companies do. They must hire topologically enhanced 20-year-olds with names that sound like new models of cars. Since most hackers are white males, their companies are disaster areas when it comes to diversity, and it follows that all of the diversity must be concentrated in the one or two employees who are not hackers. In the part of a federal equal opportunity form where Randy would simply check a box labeled Caucasian, Kia would have to attach multiple sheets on which her family tree would be ramified backwards through time 10 or 12 generations until reaching ancestors who could actually be pegged to one specific ethnic group without glossing anything over, and those ethnic groups would be intimidatingly hip ones. Not Swedes, let's say, but Laps, and not Chinese, but Hakka, and not Spanish, but Basque. Instead of doing this, on her job app for Epiphyte, she simply checked Other, and then wrote in Trans-Ethnic. In fact, Kia is trans just about every system of human categorization. And what she isn't trans, she is post. Anyway, Kia does a great job. It is part of the unspoken social contract with these people that they always do an absolutely fantastic job. And she has sent email to Randy notifying him that she has recently fielded 4 trans-Pacific telephone calls from America Shafto, who wants to know Randy's whereabouts, plans, state of mind, and purity of spirit. Kia has informed Amy that Randy's on his way to California, and has somehow insinuated, or Amy has somehow figured out, that the purpose of the visit is not business. Randy senses a small pane of glass shattering over a neurological alarm button somewhere. He is in trouble. This is divine retribution for his having dared to sit still and not do anything for 90 whole minutes. He uses his word processor to whip out a note explaining to Amy that he needs to straighten out some paperwork in order to sever the last clinging tendrils of his dead relationship with Charlene, which was such a lousy idea to begin with that it causes him to lie awake at night questioning his own judgment and fitness to live, and that he has to be in California in order to do it. He faxes the note to Semper Marine in Manila, and also faxes it to Glory 4, in case Amy's out on the water. He then does something that probably means he's certifiably crazy. He gets up and strolls up and down the business class aisle on pretext of using the bathroom, and checks out the people sitting nearby, paying special attention to their luggage, the stuff they've jammed into the overhead compartments, the bags under the seats in front of them. He is looking for anything that might contain a Van Eck freaking type of antenna. It is a completely useless thing to do, because just about any type of luggage might contain such an antenna, and he would never know it. Furthermore, an actual spy who had been planted on this plane to eavesdrop on his computer would not be sitting there holding up a big antenna and peering at an oscilloscope, but performing the check, like checking the rates for live data transmissions to the satellite, is sort of an empty ritual that makes him feel vaguely responsible and arguably non-stupid. Returning to his seat, he fires up Ordo Emacs, which is a marvelously paranoid piece of software invented by John Cantrell. Emacs, in its normal form, is the hacker's word processor, a text editor that offers little in the way of fancy formatting capabilities, but does the basic job of editing plain text very well. Your normally cryptographically paranoid hacker would create files using Emacs and then encrypt them with Ordo later. But if you forget to encrypt them, or if your laptop gets stolen before you get a chance to, or your plane crashes and you die but your laptop is sieved out of the muck by baffled but dogged crash investigators and falls into the hands of federal authorities, your files can be read. For that matter, it is possible even to find ghostly traces of old bits on a hard drive sectors, even after the file has been overwritten with new data. Ordo Emacs, on the other hand, works exactly like regular Emacs, except that it encrypts everything before writing it out to disk. At no time is plaintext ever laid down on a disk by Ordo Emacs. The only place it exists in its plain readable form is in the pixels on the screen, and in the volatile RAM of the computer, whence it vanishes the moment power is shut down. Not only that, but it's coupled to a screensaver that uses the little built-in CCD camera in the laptop to check to see if you are actually there. It can't recognize your face, but it can tell whether or not a vaguely human-shaped form is sitting in front of it. And if that vaguely human-shaped form goes away, even for a fraction of a second, it will drop into a screensaver that will blank the display and freeze the machine until such time as you type in a password or biometrically verify your identity through voice recognition. Randy opens up a document template that Epiphyte uses for internal memoranda and begins to lay out certain facts that will be fresh and no doubt stimulating to Avi, Beryl, John, Tom, and Eb. My trip to the jungle, or the drums of the hooks, or get a load of this, or he squeezed my testicles, or the weird turn pro. A tale of adventure and discovery in the majestic rainforest of northern Luzon, by Randall Lawrence Waterhouse. As I stepped on this unknown middle-aged Filipina's feet during an ill-advised ballroom dancing foray, she leaned close to me and uttered some latitude and longitude figures with a conspicuously large number of significant digits of precision, implying a maximum positional error on the order of the size of a dinner plate. Gosh, was I ever curious. Subject provided these numbers as part of a conversational gambit, thought experiment, concerning the inherent value, as in monetary, of information. A subject, coincidentally, of interest to us, the management team of Epiphyte II Corp. Examination of high-res maps of Luzon indicated that the lat and longe in question were in a hilly, let's just go ahead and call it mountainous, region some 250 kilometers north of Manila. For those of you not familiar with World War II history, this area was within the final perimeter controlled by General Yamashita, the Tiger of Malaya and conqueror of Singapore. At the end of that war, when General MacArthur had driven him and his approximately 100,000 troops out of the populated lowlands. And no, this is not just a fundamentally irrelevant historical note, as we shall see. Relayed said data to one Douglas MacArthur Shafto, referred to my exceptionally colorful and readable status reports on cable survey for more anecdotal material concerning same, who asserted, "Someone is trying to send you a message." Note, all cheesy dialogue hereinafter is DMS's. And offered his assistance with a vigor bordering on scary aggressiveness. DMS is energetic and enterprising to a degree that, from time to time, leaves certain persons, for example, those burdened with a petty fear of death or torture, uneasy. See my prior speculation as to possibility DMS may have been born with a redundant Y chromosome. Primary role of yours truly became as follows. Source of repetitious and evidently irritating counsels of caution, restraint, other virtues given a low priority by DMS, who cites his longevity, which unavoidably exceeds that of yours truly as he was born before me, network of close personal relationships, murky, globe-spanning, reputedly puissant. Financial prosperity, commodities, for example, precious metals, distributed among many locations, DMS declines to reveal, and, as trump card, the corporeal perfection of his girlfriend. She must carry an umbrella while out of doors lest her face cause pilots of overflying commercial airliners to pitch forward, dumb and inert, onto their control yokes. All as proof that the ideas shared by yours truly, vis-a-vis how to avoid death, dismemberment, etc., need not be given more than the most cursory attention. Yours truly's only bargaining chips were, appropriately and ironically enough, information. Namely, the final few digits of the Latin launch, which were withheld from DMS, lest he simply go there himself and check them out. Note, DMS is honest to a fault, and so the concern is not that DMS might steal or appropriate anything, but that situation would get out of hand. to the extent it ever was in hand to begin with. Plans were made for a journey. Mission, in DMS parlance, to said lat and launch. Extra batteries were purchased for the GPS receiver. See attached expense report. Drinking water, etc. laid in. A jeepney was retained. Concept of jeepney is impossible to convey fully here. A minibus, usually named after a pop star, biblical figure, or abstract theological concept, whose engine and frame come from American or Nipponese Auto Company, but whose entire body, seats, upholstery, and incrustations of lurid decor are locally manufactured by high-spirited artisans. Jeepneys are normally made outside of Manila in towns or barangays, semi-autonomous neighborhoods, that specialize in same. The design, materials, style, etc. of a jeepney reflect its provenance, just as good wine allegedly betrays climate, soil, etc. of its terroir. Ours was, anomalously, a perfectly monochromatic jeepney, manufactured out of pure stainless steel in the Stainless Steel Fabrication Specialization Barangay of San Pablo, with, unlike normal jeepneys, no colored decorations at all. Everything either stainless steel colored or, where use was made of electric lights, pure, piercing halogen white with bluish tinge, nicely complementing hue of stainless steel. Seats in back were stainless steel benches with surprisingly ergonomic lumbar support capabilities. Name of our jeepney was The Grace of God. Readers of this memo will be disappointed to know that Bong Bong Gad, sick, designer, owner, driver, proprietor of the vehicle, anticipated the inevitable, "There but for the grace of God go I," witticism, by unloading same on yours truly while we were still shaking hands. Filipinos go in for long handshakes, and the first part to initiate termination of a handshake, usually the non-Filipino, is invariably left with a nagging feeling that he is a shithead. Yours truly, in discreet one-on-one mode with DMS, adverted to lack of windows in the rear passenger section of the Grace of God as prima facie evidence that it lacked air conditioning, a technology widely adopted in Philippine islands. DMS evinced skepticism as to moral fiber of yours truly, commenced with a series of probing questions aimed at establishing my commitment to mission, fiduciary responsibility to Epiphyte shareholders, level of physical and mental vigor, and overall level of seriousness. Being serious is some kind of umbrella concept strongly correlated with my fitness to live, to have the privilege of knowing DMS, and to go on dates with his daughter. This gives me an opening to mention what would normally be no one's business but my own, but which in these circumstances it is ethically mandated that I disclose, namely that I am infatuated with daughter of DMS, and that while not exactly reciprocating these feelings at full strength, she finds me sufficiently non-loathsome to have dinner with me from time to time. It has only occurred to me at this very moment that my pursuit of relationship with the female in question, one America, sick by name, would in context of modern U.S. society be classified as sexual harassment, and that if desired culmination is achieved, it might be classified as sexual abuse or rape, owing to power imbalance existing between me and her. Namely, yours truly is on management team of Corp that has retained Semper Marine for large job and provided them with majority of their revenue during last fiscal year. Anyone with thoughts of summoning federal authorities to apprehend me upon arrival at SFO and expose my misdeeds and subject me to public disgrace and compulsory consciousness-raising workshops is advised to acquaint him or herself with the Shaftos first, and to at least remain open to possibility that Dad's martial prowess, in combination with traditional feelings of psychotic protectiveness toward his female offspring, combined with daughter's habit of carrying large Palawan stabbing weapon known as Cree, and daughter's overall psychic fierceness and physical fitness and courage exceeding that of yours truly, mitigate any perceived power imbalance, particularly given that most of our interactions take place in settings which lend themselves admirably to discreet homicide and corpse disposal. In other words, I make you aware of this amour stuff not as confession of personal misdeeds, but to make full disclosure of situation that could influence my judgment vis-a-vis Semper Marine and conceivably negatively impact shareholder value. Or, much more plausibly, that could be seen as doing so by minority shareholder lawyers who infest our industry like guinea worms and used as pretext for legal action. Back to the question at hand, then. Yours truly asserted calmly, feeling that vigorous assertions would be perceived by DMS as defensiveness and hence a de facto confession of lack of seriousness, that, one, a couple of days' travel in open AC-less vehicle through Philippine hinterland would be a day at the beach, a picnic, a walk in the park, and a Sunday stroll all rolled into one. And two, furthermore, that even if it were the most hideous torture, yours truly would gladly undergo it, given that the stakes, for all concerned, including Epiphyte shareholders, were so high and generally serious. In retrospect, one and two in close succession seemed to betray some kind of hedging strategy on part of yours truly. However, at the time, DMS was mollified, formally withdrew previous accusations as to moral fiber, etc., and divulged that use of jeepney was tactical masterstroke on his, DMS's, part, in that, where we were going, a Merc with smoked glass or $50,000 Land Rover, or by extension, any vehicle with extravagances such as upholstered seats, windows with glass in them, shock absorbers dating from post-Kennedy assassination era, etc., etc., would only draw undesired attention to Mission. America Shafto remained in Manila to stay in touch with Mission via radio and, I supposed, to call in napalm strikes should we find ourselves embroiled. Bong Bong Gad and his approximately 12-year-old son, business associate Fidel, occupied front seat. DMS and yours truly shared rear passenger section with three mysterious, precisely packed GI green duffel bags, approximately 100 kilos of drinking water in plastic bottles, and two Asian gentlemen in their 30s or 40s who exhibited stereotypical inscrutability, impassivity, dignity, etc., etc., during the first 4 hours of the journey, which were spent simply trying to drive from center of Manila to northern outskirts of same. Nationality of these two was not immediately evident. Many Filipinos are racially almost pure Chinese, even though their families have been living here for centuries. Perhaps this explained strongly Asian features of our traveling companions and, I now had to assume, business associates. Proverbial ice was broken as one consequence of pig truck incident, which occurred on four-lane highway, narrowed by construction to two, leading north from Manila. Casual observation of Filipino swine suggests that their ludicrous pink tabloid-sized ears function as heat exchangers, as do, for example, the tongues of dogs. They are transported in vehicles consisting of big cage constructed on bed of a straight, as opposed to semi-articulated, truck. Construction of such vehicles appears to tax local resources to the point where they are only economical when maximum conceivable number of swine are packed into confines at all times. Heat buildup ensues. Pigs adapt by fighting their way to perimeter of cage and hanging ear heat exchangers out over the side to flap in the wind of the truck's motion. The appearance of such a vehicle when approached from behind can be easily envisioned without further description. Readers who devote a few moments' consideration to the subject of excreta need not be pounded over the head vis-a-vis what flies, sprays, drips, etc. from such vehicles either. The pig truck incident was a humorous demonstration of applied hydrodynamics, though since no actual water was involved, perhaps excretodynamics or scatodynamics might better fit. The grace of God had been following a representative pig truck for some miles in the hopes of passing it. The sheer quantity of excess body heat radiating from its vast phased array of flapping pink ears caused several of our drinking water bottles to achieve full rolling boil and explode. Bong Bong Gad maintained a respectful distance because of excreta hazards, which in no way simplified the problem of passing the truck. Tension climbed to a palpable level, and Bong Bong was subjected to a steadily increasing stream of good-natured heckling and unsolicited driving advice from passenger area, especially from DMS, who viewed lingering unwelcome presence of pig truck in our planned trajectory as personal affront, and hence challenged to be overcome with all due pluck, vigor, can-do spirit, and other qualities known to be possessed in abundance by DMS. After some time, Bong Bong made his move, using one hand to manipulate steering wheel and other to timeshare equally important responsibilities of shifting gears and depressing the horn button. As we drew alongside the pig truck, which was on my side of the jeepney, the truck slalomed toward us as if perhaps swerving around some real or imagined roadside hazard. The primary horn of the grace of God was apparently going unheard. Possibly because it was competing for audio bandwidth against large numbers of swine voicing their displeasure in same frequency range. With aplomb, normally seen only among senescent English butlers, Bong Bong reached up with his horn gearshift hand and gripped a brilliant stainless steel chain flailing from ceiling of cab with a stainless steel crucifix on the end of it, and jerked downwards, energizing the secondary, tertiary, and quaternary honking systems. A trio of tuba-sized stainless steel horns mounted to the roof of the Grace of God, and collectively drawing so much power that our vehicle's speed dropped by, I would estimate, 10 kilometers an hour as its energies were diverted into decibel production. A demi-hyperbolic swath of agricultural crops 20 miles long was flattened to the ground by the blast, and hundreds of miles north, the Taiwanese government, its collective ears still ringing, filed a diplomatic protest with the Philippine ambassador. Dead whales and dolphins washed ashore on the beaches of Luzon for days, and sonar operators and passing U.S. Navy submarines were sent into early retirement with blood streaming from their ears. Terrified by this sound, all of the pigs, I would suppose, voided their bowels just as the driver of the pig truck swerved violently away from us. Certain first-year physics conservation of momentum issues dictated that I be showered with former pig bowel contents in order to enhance shareholder value. This was evidently the funniest thing that the two Asian-looking gentlemen had ever seen and rendered them helpless for several minutes. One of them actually retched from laughing too hard, the first time that our vehicle's lack of windows came in handy. The other extended his hand and introduced himself as one Jean in Guyenne. This is the French male name Jean, and not the Anglo-female name Jean. Jean and Guyenne looked at me expectantly after telling me his name, as did DMS, as if they were expecting me to get a fairly obvious joke. Perhaps preoccupied with hygienic issues, I failed to get it, and they pointed out to me that when Jean is pronounced like John and Guyenne is pronounced the way a lot of Americans mangle it, the name sounds arguably like John Wayne, which is how I was encouraged to address this Jean Nguyen from that point onwards. It seemed in retrospect that I was being given an opportunity to have a small chuckle at Jean Nguyen's expense, and thereby to even the scales in some small but symbolically important sense, for the pig shit incident. My failure to exploit this opportunity left everyone feeling mildly uneasy and like they still owed me one. The other gentleman was introduced as Jackie Wu. He spoke English with a vaguely East Indian crackle, which led me to peg him speculatively as a Malay Peninsula native of Chinese descent, for example, from Singapore or Penang. First day's travel got us across the central Luzon plain, rice and sugarcane, to the town of San Jose at the foot of the southernmost extension of the Cordillera Central, trees and bugs. By this point it was dark, and to my relief, neither DMS nor Bong Bong was eager to brave twisty Cordillera roads in darkness. We stayed in a guest house. At this point, having devoted much time to detailed pig truck description, I will elide various details concerning San Juan, its inhabitants of various taxonomic phyla, some of which I had never encountered until that night, the character-building nature of our lodgings, and in particular, their fanciful plumbing system, which was a credit to the imagination, though not the hydrostatic acumen of its anonymous creator. It was the kind of hostel that makes a traveler eager to get an early and explosively sudden start in the morning, which we did. A note now about the physical properties of space, as perceived by human beings imprisoned within bodies of limited physical capabilities. I have long noticed that space seems to be more compressed, more involuted, somehow physically larger in some places than others. Covering a distance of 3 or 4 miles in the totally open scrublands of central Washington state is a simple matter, and takes less than an hour on foot, and only a few minutes if you have some kind of vehicle. Covering the same distance in Manhattan takes much longer. It's not just that the space of Manhattan is more physically obstructed, though it definitely is, but that there is some kind of psychological impact that alters the way you perceive and experience distance. You cannot see as far, and what you do see is full of people, buildings, goods, vehicles, and other stuff that it takes your brain some amount of effort to sort through, to process. Even if you had some kind of magic carpet that would glide past all of the physical obstructions, the distance would seem much longer and would take longer to cover, simply because your mind would have to deal with more stuff. The same thing is true of a jungle type of environment as opposed to the plains. Traversing the physical space is basically an ongoing battle against hundreds of different combatants, each one of which is, to a traveler, an obstruction, a hazard, or both. That is, no matter which one of them predominates in a given 10-square-meter area, you are still screwed as far as getting across that 10 square meters is concerned. There are roads through the jungle, but even when they are in good repair, they seem more like bottlenecks than vectors of motion, and they are never in good repair. Mudslides, fallen trees, huge chuck holes, and the like block them every few hundred meters. Also, the same perceptual thing is at work here. You can't see more than a few meters in any direction, and what you do see is dense with visual inputs, some of which, like butterflies, are okay, beautiful. My reason for mentioning this is that I know that everyone who reads this probably has multiple maps of Luzon on their wall or in their computer, which when consulted will cause it to seem as if we are dealing with a triflingly small area and covering minuscule distances. But you must try not to think this way. And instead imagine that Luzon is effectively as large as, say, the United States west of the Mississippi. In terms of the time it takes to get around the place, it is at least that big. I mention this not out of some impulse to mule and convince you all of how strenuously I have worked, but because until you grasp this central fact of the effectively vast size of this part of the world, you will be completely unable to believe the dumbfounding facts that I am slowly getting around to revealing. We went into the mountains. Around midday, we encountered our first military roadblock. Distance covered from San Juan was pathetic from cartographic POV, but in terms of unexpected hassles creatively surmounted, wrenchingly difficult decisions made, and pits of despair climbed out of by emotional fingernails, should be considered magnificent achievement on par with any given day of the Lewis and Clark expedition, excluding, of course, anomalous days such as their first encounters with Ursus Horribilis and their epic stalking-foot traversal of Bitterroot Range. Roadblock was established in the low-key Filipino style, one man in military uniform, U.S. Army cast-offs, standing by roadside smoking and beckoning. We were at a rare wide spot in the road, a place where oncoming chicken-playing vehicles could pull aside abjectly. Four members of Army, later pegged by insignia-savvy DMS as a first lieutenant, a sergeant, and two privates, had ensconced selves on parked Humvee-type vehicle with absurdly long whip antenna clamped to bumper. The privates, armed with M16s, stiffly unfolded selves from repose and adopted positions flanking the Grace of God from behind, keeping their weapons pointed vaguely at the ground, as if more worried about entomological threats than our little band of travelers. Sergeant was armed with what I first perceived as L-shaped nightstick, fashioned from parts scavenged from plumbing aisle of home improvement store and painted black, but on further examination proved to be a submachine gun. Said sergeant approached Bong Bong Gad's door and conversed with same in Tagalog. Lieutenant was armed only with sidearm and supervised these operations from a shaded area near the Humvee, seeming to espouse a hands-off as opposed to micromanaging leadership style. This inspection was limited to the sergeant peering in through TGOG's glassless windows and exchanging hearty greetings with DMS. Evidently, Jean Nguyen and Jackie Wu spoke even less Tagalog than yours truly. We were then allowed to proceed, although I noticed that the lieutenant immediately commenced a radio transmission. "The sergeant say there are nice people around," Bong Bong Gad explained to me, using a coy local euphemism for MPA, or New People's Army, a supposedly revolutionary but evidently somewhat feckless guerrilla organization descended in a direct line from the Hukbalahops, or Hucks, the fighters who resisted the Nipponese occupation, but not so desultorily in World War II. We then covered an amount of distance equivalent, in terms of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, to one more Lewis and Clark expedition day. A convenient unit of distance, danger, perspirational weight loss, poor sphincter control, wishing you were at home, exasperation and emotional toll, which I will hereinafter abbreviate as LAC. So after one LAC, we arrived at another roadblock similar to the first, except that here there was a troop truck in addition to the Humvee, and some tents pitched, and a pit latrine, whose odor and appearance suggested a long-standing military presence in this area. A luckless private was made to crawl underneath the grace of God with a flashlight, inspecting its undercarriage. The three duffel bags were removed and their contents spread out. I should mention that upon my joining this expedition in Manila, DMS had gone through my bag with a level of inquisitiveness annoying at the time, refused to allow me to bring certain items such as pharmaceuticals, and transferred remaining items to clear plastic bags of Ziploc type, which were placed in the duffels. Merits of this highly modular approach now became clear as inspection of our cargo was wondrously facilitated. Duffels were simply upended over tarps, spread on ground, and contents inspected by sight through transparent inner bags, sometimes by feel to check for compositional inhomogeneities. Certain of these bags contained cartons of American brand tobacco products, which, as expected, did not make it back into the duffels. Most of my DMS-mandated supply of alkaline AA batteries, which I had thought radically out of proportion to projected demand, also vanished at this time. We were sent on our way, and after approximately 0.5 LAC, mostly occasioned by need to remove downed tree from roadway, arrived at a town that appeared seemingly out of nowhere in Jungle Valley, astride a river. Slept like a dead man in startlingly decent guesthouse that night. Woke up next morning and looked out window to observe large crowd of locals milling around in street below in their best meshback caps and American basketball t-shirts. Descended stairs to discover DMS in dining room, strategically flanked by Jean and Guyane and Jackie Wu at other tables in corners of room, wearing climatically inappropriate jackets and generally projecting the image of concealed weapon-equipped badass motherfuckers not to be trifled with. Not wishing to interfere with this psychodrama, yours truly took innocuous position at yet another table, well away from projected gunfire corridors, accepted coffee from proprietor, declined local delicacies, negotiated, see expense report, for a loan of bowl and spoon, breakfasted upon Captain Crunch and warm UHT milk from duffel bag. Former had been packed into a Ziploc that, when fully loaded, adopted the distinctive pillow shape of an individual nugget of Captain Crunch, only much larger. Explosive crunching noises of nuggets caused yours truly to feel conspicuous and Western. Jean and Guyane and Jackie Wu had declined all refreshments except tea, the better to project image of hair-trigger alertness and potential for instantaneous violence. DMS was eating an omelet with approximate diameter of a hula hoop, and engaging in one short conversation after another with locals, who were admitted through front door building one at a time by proprietor and allowed to present their cases to DMS as if he were a traveling magistrate. Between two such interviews, DMS noted my presence in room and bade me join him. I moved my Captain Crunch infrastructure to corner of table not occupied by omelet and sat with him during the next couple of dozen interviews, which were conducted in mixture of English and Tagalog. Crowd in street dwindled gradually as they were interviewed and then dismissed by DMS. Subject matter of interviews could be induced by yours truly only by recognizing occasional English words and adopting a basically intuitive pattern recognition approach not amenable to rational explication here. Most common key words, Nippon, the Nipponese, the war, gold, treasure, excavations, Yamashita, mass executions. Emotional tenor of these conversations consisted of polite but extreme skepticism on part of DMS, while confronted by desperate need to be believed on part of interviewees. In the end, DMS did not believe any of them as far as I could discern. They either became obstreperous and had to be shown the door, glancing warily at Jean and Guyane and Jackie Wu, or adopted a wounded and aggrieved stance. DMS was amused by the former and disgusted by the latter. Yours truly mused silently upon inappropriateness of his own presence in this setting and fondly remembered predictable comforts of home, even of Manila. Upon completion of breakfast and of interviews, DMS divulged, in response to my inquiries, that he had been at it for 2 hours before I had arrived, and that formation of this milling crowd occurs spontaneously before doors of any lodgings he takes in the Philippines, owing to his reputation as treasure hunter. We had avoided it in San Juan only because he goes there frequently and has already interviewed everyone in region with Nipponese war gold stories, found 99.9% of them lacking credibility, investigating the remaining 0.1% with occasionally lucrative results. The grace of God had been washed and buffed by Fidel Gad in magnificently insouciant gesture of defiance of jungle elements. We proceeded to cross river. Racial variations were conspicuous on faces and in physiognomies of townspeople. Philippines were settled by countless overlapping waves of prehistoric migrants, each racially and linguistically incompatible with the last. This, in combination with the spatial involution phenomenon which I have, I think, sufficiently belabored by this point, makes for your basic patchwork of different ethnic groups. The fork in the river around which this town was nucleated was meeting point of unofficial turfs of three such different cultures. Lore of bright lights, or even dim flickering ones, has drawn thousands down from mountains in recent generations to establish several distinct barangays. This morning's interviewees were migrants from the mountains, or their sons or grandsons, who claimed to have first-hand knowledge of sites of Yamashita's hordes, or to have heard about same from late ancestors. After covering about 1.5 LACs through jungle, roads, slopes, and conditions getting worse all the time, we encountered another military roadblock that had, somewhat incredibly to my mind, been established at a pass over a ridge overlooking some rice terraces that had, even more incredibly, been hacked out of an essentially vertical south-facing slope thousands of years ago by the evidently fearsomely tenacious ancestors of the locals. Here we were thoroughly searched. My testicles were squeezed at some length by a sergeant with a pencil mustache, whose motives did not appear to be sexual, but who simultaneously looked me searchingly in the eye, awaiting a look of submission or hopelessness on the face of the squeezed. The others were subjected to the same treatment and probably endured it with more stoicism than yours truly. No lethal weapons were found attached to any of our scrota, but surprise! Jean Wayne, Ningayen, and Jackie Wu were discovered to be armed to the teeth, and DMS somewhat less so. This is the part where yours truly expected to be shot in the nape of the neck whilst kneeling above a shallow grave, but ironically the authorities were far more interested in my cache of Cap'n Crunch than the weaponry sported by my comrades. Negotiations took place between DMS and the captain in charge of this outpost in the privacy of a tent. DMS emerged with a thinner wallet and full clearance to proceed, on the conditions that, 1, all supplies of Cap'n Crunch be donated to the officer's mess, and, 2, a full inventory of weapons and ammo would be taken upon our return and compared with today's findings to make sure that we were not smuggling arms to the nice people around. 3 days' excruciatingly slow travel, comprising maybe another 10 LACs, awaited us. According to my map and GPS, we were circumnavigating a cluster of active volcanoes that frequently spew out lahars, mud avalanches, which, when they impact upon ruts in the jungle that I'm here calling roads, cause logistical problems well into the realms of the absurd. We passed entire towns that had been buried and abandoned. Church steeples projected at angles from the gray mud, held up by the same flows that had knocked them askew. Skulls of goats, dogs, etc., protruded from mud that had hardened around living animals like concrete. We bedded down nightly at small settlements after propitiating locals with gifts of penicillin, which Filipinos used like aspirin, batteries, disposable lighters, and whatever else had been left to us by the soldiers at the roadblocks. We slept on benches, floor, roof, or front seats of the Grace of God beneath mosquito nets. Finally, when my GPS revealed that we were less than 10 kilometers from our mysterious destination, a local instructed us to wait in a nearby village. We remained there for a day and a night, resting up and reading books. DMS is never without a milk crate of techno-thrillers. Until, at dawn, we were approached by a trio of very young short men, one of whom carried an AK-47. He and his brethren climbed on the roof of the Grace of God, and we proceeded into a jungle track so narrow that I would not have pegged it even as a footpath. A couple of kilometers into the jungle, we reached a point where we spent more time pushing the jeepney than riding in it. Shortly thereafter, we left Bong Bong and Fidel and one of the duffels behind, the four of us taking turns humping the two other duffels. I consulted the GPS and verified that, although we had for a time, alarmingly, moved away from the destination, we were now moving toward it again. We were 8,000 meters away and proceeding at a rate that varied between about 500 and 1,000 meters per hour, depending on whether we were moving steeply uphill or steeply downhill. It was around noon. Those of you with even rudimentary math skills will have anticipated that when the sun went down, we were still a few thousand meters away. The three Filipinos, our guides, guards, captors, or whatever they were, wore the obligatory U.S. t-shirts, which make it so easy nowadays to underestimate cultural differences. They had not yet, however, attained trans-ethnicity. While in town they were shod in flip-flops, but in the jungle they went barefoot. I have owned pairs of shoes less durable than the calluses on their feet. They spoke a language that apparently had zero in common with the Tagalog I'd heard. Tagalog is the old name, and government is ragging on people to call it Pilipina, as if to imply that it is in some sense a common language of the archipelago, which, as these guys demonstrated, is not the case. DMS had to converse with them in English. At one point, he gave one a throwaway plastic ballpoint pen, and their faces absolutely lit up. Then we had to scrounge up two more pens for his companions. It was like Christmas. Progress halted for several minutes while they marveled at the pen's handy clicking mechanisms and doodled on the palms of their hands. The American t-shirts were, in other words, not worn as Americans wear them, but in the same spirit that the Queen of England wore the exotic Kohinoor diamond on her crown. Not for the first time, I was overtaken by a strong, not exactly in Kansas feeling. We slogged through the inevitable late-afternoon thunderstorm and kept moving into the night. DMS produced U.S. Army MREs, meals ready to eat, from the duffels, only a couple of weeks past their stenciled expiration dates. The Filipino men found these nearly as exciting as the ballpoint pen, and saved the disposable foil trays for later use as roofing material. We started slogging again. The moon came out, which represented a bit of luck. I fell down a couple of times and banged myself up on trees, which ended up being a good thing because it put me into a state of mild shock, dulling the pain and jacking me up on adrenaline. Our guides, at one point, seemed a little uncertain as to which way they should go. I took a fix with the GPS, using the screen's nightlight function, and established that we were no more than 50 meters away from the destination, almost too small an error for my GPS to resolve. In any event, it told us roughly which direction to proceed, and we trudged through the trees for another few moments. The guides became animated and very cheerful. Finally, they had gotten their bearings. They knew where we were. I bumped into something heavy, cold, and immovable that nearly broke my knee. I reached down to touch it, expecting to find a rock outcropping, but instead felt something smooth and metallic. It seemed to be a stack of smaller units, maybe comparable in size to loaves of bread. "Is this what we're looking for?" I asked. DMS turned on a battery-powered lantern and whipped the beam around in my direction. I was instantly blinded by a thigh-high stack of gold bars, about a meter and a half on a side, sitting out in the middle of the jungle, unmarked and unguarded. DMS came over and sat down on top of it and lit a cigar. After a while, we counted the bars and measured them. They are trapezoidal in cross-section, about 10 centimeters wide and 10 high, and about 40 centimeters in length. This enabled us to estimate their mass at about 75 kilograms each, which works out to 2,400 troy ounces. Since gold is normally measured in troy ounces and not in kilograms, I'm going to make a wild guess that these bars were intended to weigh an even 2,500 troy ounces apiece. At current rates, $400 per troy ounce, this means each bar is worth $1 million. There are 5 layers of bars in the stack, each layer consisting of 24 bars, and so the value of the stack is $120 million. Both the mass estimate and the value estimate presume that the bars are nearly pure gold. I took a rubbing of the stamp from one of the bars, which bears the mark of the Bank of Singapore. Each bar is marked with a unique serial number, and I copied down as many of those as I could see. Then we went back to Manila. All along the way, I tried to imagine the logistics of getting even a single one of those gold bars from the jungle out to the nearest bank, where it could be turned into something useful, like cash. Let me transition to a Q&A format here. Question. Randy, I get the feeling that you are about to lay out in detail all of the hassles that would be involved in moving this gold over land, so let's just cut to the chase and talk about helicopters. Answer. There is no place for a helicopter to land. Terrain is extremely rugged. The nearest sufficiently flat place is about 1 kilometer away. It would have to be cleared. In Vietnam, this was accomplished using blockbuster bombs, but this is probably not an option here. Trees would have to be cut down, creating a gap in the jungles conspicuous from the air. Question. Who cares if it's conspicuous? Who's going to see it? Answer. As should be obvious from my anecdote, the people who control this gold have connections in Manila. We may assume that the area is overflown by the Philippine Air Force regularly and kept under radar surveillance. Question. What would be involved in getting the bars to the nearest decent road? Answer. They would have to be carried over the jungle's trails I have described. Each bar weighs as much as a full-grown man. Question. Couldn't they be cut up into smaller pieces? Answer. DMS rates it as unlikely that the current owners would permit this. Question. Is there any chance of smuggling the gold through the military checkpoints? Answer. Obviously not in the case of a mass shipment. The gold weighs a total of around 10 tons and would require a truck that could not negotiate most of the roads we saw. Concealing 10 tons of goods from the inspectors at these checkpoints is not possible. Question. How about smuggling the bars out one at a time? Answer. Still very tricky. Might be possible to hike the bars out to an intermediate point somewhere, melt or chop them down, and somehow secrete them in the body of a jeepney or other vehicle, then drive the vehicle to Manila and extract the gold. This operation would have to be repeated 100 times. Driving the same vehicle past one of these checkpoints 100 or even 2 times would strike them as, to put it mildly, odd. Even if this were possible, there is the payment issue. Question. What is the payment issue? Answer. Obviously, the people who control the gold want to be paid for it. Paying them in more gold or in precious gems would be ludicrous. They do not have bank accounts. They have to be paid in Philippine pesos. Anything bigger than about a 500 peso note is useless in this area. A 500 peso note is worth about $20, and so it would be necessary to bring 6 million of them into the jungle to perform the transaction. Based on some rudimentary calculations I have made here using a mechanic's caliper and the contents of my wallet, the stack of 500 peso notes would be about... Please wait while I switch my calculator over to the scientific notation mode. 25,000 inches high, or, if you prefer the metric system, something like 2/3 of a kilometer. If you stacked the bills 1 meter high, you would need 600 or 700 such stacks, which, if jammed close together, would cover an area about 3 meters on a side. Basically, we are talking about a large rider box truck full of money. This would have to be transported into the middle of the jungle, and obviously melting down cash and secreting inside of a truck is not an option. Question. Since the military seems to be the big obstacle here, why not simply cut a deal with them? Let them keep a big cut of the proceeds in exchange for not hassling us. Answer. Because the money would go to the MPA, which would use it to buy weapons for the purpose of killing people in the military. Question. There must be some way to use the value of this gold to leverage some kind of extraction operation. Answer. The gold is worthless to a bank until it has been assayed. Until then, it is only a blurry Polaroid of a stack of yellow objects in what seems to be a jungle. In order to perform an assay, you need to go into the jungle, find the gold, bore out a sample, and transport it safely back to a large city. But this proves nothing. Even if the potential backers believe that your essay really came from the jungle, that is, that you did not switch samples along the way, all they know now is the purity of one end of one bar in the stack. Basically, it is not possible to obtain full value for this gold until the entire stack has been extracted and taken to a vault where it can be systematically assayed. Question. Could you maybe just get the gold to some local bank and then sell it at a steep discount so that the burden of transporting it would be on someone else's shoulders? Answer. DMS relates the tale of one such transaction in a provincial town in North Luzon, which was interrupted when local entrepreneurs literally blew one of the bank's walls off with dynamite, came in and grabbed both the gold and the cash that was going to be used to pay for the gold. DMS asserts he would rather slit his own throat quietly than walk into a small-town bank with anything worth more than a few tens of thousands of dollars. Question. Is the situation basically impossible, then? Answer. It is basically impossible. Question. Then what was the point of the whole exercise? Answer. To come full circle to the first thing DMS said. It was to send us a message. Question. What is the message? Answer. That money is not worth having if you can't spend it. That certain people have a lot of money that they badly want to spend, and that if we can give them a way to spend it through the crypt, that these people will be very happy, and conversely, that if we screw up, they will be very sad, and that whether they are happy or sad, they will be eager to share these emotions with us, the shareholders and management team of Epiphyte Corp. And now I am going to email this to all of you and then summon the flight attendant and demand the array of alcoholic beverages I so richly deserve. Cheers. R. Randall Lawrence Waterhouse. Current meat space coordinates, hot from the GPS receiver card in my laptop, 27 degrees, 14.95 minutes north latitude, 143 degrees, 17.44 minutes east longitude. Nearest geographical feature, the Bonin Islands. Rocket. Julietta has retreated somewhere far up beyond the Arctic Circle. Shafto has been pursuing her like a dogged Mountie, slogging across the sexual tundra on frayed snowshoes and leaping heroically from floe to floe, but she remains about as distant and about as reachable as Polaris. She has spent more time lately with Enoch Root than with him, and Root's a celibate priest or something. Or is he? On the few occasions Bobby Shafto has actually gotten Julietta to crack a smile, she has immediately begun to ask difficult questions. Did you have sex with Glory, Bobby? Did you use a condom? Is it possible that she might have become pregnant? Can you absolutely rule out the possibility that you have a child in the Philippines? How old would he or she be right now? Let's see. You fucked her on Pearl Harbor Day, so the child would have been born in early September of 42. Your child would be 14, 15 months old now, perhaps just learning to walk. How precious. It always gives Shafto the willies when tough girls like Julietta get all fluttery and slip into baby talk. At first, he figures it's all a ruse to keep him at arm's length. This smuggler's daughter, this atheist gorilla intellectual, what does she care about some girl in Manila? Snap out of it, woman! There's a war on! Then he comes up with a better explanation. Julietta's pregnant. The day begins with the sound of a ship's horn in the harbor at Norsbrook. The town is a jumble of neat, wide houses packed onto a spur of rock that sticks out into the Gulf of Bothnia, forming the southern shore of a slender but deep inlet lined with wharves. Half the town now turns out beneath an unsettling, turbulent peach-and-salmon dawn to see this quaint harbor being deflowered by an inexorable steel phallus. It comes complete with spirochetes. Several score men in black dress uniforms stand on the top of the thing, lined up neat as stanchions. As the blast of the horn fades away, echoing back and forth between the stony ridges, it becomes possible to hear the spirochetes singing, belting out a bawdy German sea shanty which Bobby Shafto last heard during a convoy attack in the Bay of Biscay. Two other people in Norsbrook will recognize that tune. Shafto looks for Enoch Root in his church cellar, but he is not present. His bed and lamp are cold. Maybe the local chapter of Societas Eruditorum holds its meetings before dawn. Or maybe he's found another welcoming bed. But trusty old Gunter Bischoff can be seen leaning out the window of his seaside garret, elbows in the air and his trusty Zeiss 735 binoculars clamped over his face, scanning the lines of the invading ship. The Swedes stand with arms folded for a minute or so, regarding this apparition. Then they make some kind of collective decision that it does not exist, that nothing has happened here. They turn their backs, pad grumpily into their houses, begin to boil coffee. Being neutral is no less strange, no less fraught with awkward compromises than being a belligerent. Unlike most of Europe, they can rest assured that the Germans are not here to invade them or sink their ships. On the other hand, the vessel's presence is a violation of their sovereign territory, and they ought to run down there with pitchforks and flintlocks and fight the Huns off. On the third hand, this boat was probably made out of Swedish iron. Shafto fails at first to recognize the German vessel as a U-boat because it is shaped all wrong. A regular U-boat is shaped like a surface vessel, except longer and skinnier. Which is to say, it has a sort of V-shaped hull and a flat deck, studded with guns, from which rises a gigantic conning tower that is covered with junk, AK-AK guns, antennas, stanchions, safety lines, spray shields. The Krauts would put cuckoo clocks up there, too, if they had room. As a regular U-boat plunges through the waves, thick black smoke spews from its diesel engines. This one is just a torpedo as long as a football field. Instead of a conning tower, there's a streamlined bulge on the top, hardly noticeable. No guns, no antennas, no cuckoo clocks. The whole thing's as smooth as a river rock. And it's not making smoke or noise, just venting a little bit of steam. The diesels don't rumble. The fucking thing doesn't even seem to have diesels. Instead, there is a dim whine, like the sound that came out of Angelo's Messerschmitt. Shafto intercepts Bischoff just as the latter is coming down the steps of the inn carrying a duffel bag the size of a dead sea lion. He's panting with exertion, or maybe excitement.
"That's the one,"
he gasps. He sounds like he's talking to himself, but he's speaking English, so he must be addressing Shafto.
"That's the rocket."
"Rocket?"
"Runs on rocket fuel. Hydrogen peroxide, 85%. Never has to recharge his verdammt batteries. Clocks 28 knots, submerged.
Oh, that's my baby."
He's as fluttery as Julietta.
"Can I help you carry anything?"
"Footlocker, upstairs," Bischoff says.
Shafto stomps up the narrow staircase to find Bischoff's room stripped to the bedsprings and a pile of gold coins on the table, weighing down a thank-you note addressed to the owners. The black locker rests in the middle of the floor like a child's coffin. A wild hollering noise reaches his ears through the open window. Bischoff is down there, heading for the pier beneath his duffel bag, and his men, up on the rocket, have caught sight of him. The U-boat has launched a dinghy, which is surging towards the pier like a racing skull. Shafto heaves the locker up onto his shoulder and trudges down the stairs. It reminds him of shipping out, which is what Marines are supposed to do, and which he has not actually done in a long time. Vicarious excitement is not as good as the real thing, he finds.